is Danielle from The Jaws Curator, and this is episode 30 of Art for Your Ear. This episode is supported by Saatchi Art, the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. All right, this is a crazy episode. I feel like I'm opening an art history book and calling one of my favorite artists of all time to ask whatever I want to ask. Luckily, this artist is alive, so that makes it easier. Somehow I managed to get American artist Wayne White on the podcast. Have you seen his movie Beauty is Embarrassing? If not, go and get it right now. It's my favorite art documentary ever. I have so many questions for him. And let's just hope that I don't burst into tears or throw up or both. All right. Deep breath. Oh, and P.S. Usually I bleep out the occasional cuss, but that's kind of part of Wayne's charm, so I'm leaving it all in. Okay, ready? Calling L.A. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Wayne.
Yes, Danielle?
Yes.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Good. Are you ready?
I am.
I have to admit, I'm so nervous about this.
Don't be. Well, let me shut this door. Hold on.
Okay.
Okay.
Are you in your studio?
No, I'm upstairs in an office.
Nice. I'm so happy to finally talk to you.
Yeah, well.
It's so weird after like years of email.
Well, thanks for putting me in your book.
Oh my gosh, thanks for being in it. Did you know that you were one of the first people I emailed to do it?
No.
Yeah, you, I so badly wanted you in it, and I thought, oh, he'll never say yes, so I just wasn't going to bother. And then I thought, what's the worst that's going to happen? He'll either say no or he won't email me back. And then you were the first one to email me back.
And then the worst happened. I was in it.
I loved it. I'm so thrilled that you're in there, and I can't even believe that you're doing this. And so excited. And yeah, crazy, crazy nervous. You should see my notes. Like normally it's like this nice typed list. This looks like a beautiful mind. It's like it's weird scrawlings and questions. And so I don't know. We're just going to wing it and see what happens.
Sounds good.
Okay. I'm going to try and not be a super fangirl and try not to ask you everything that you always get asked. Have you ever seen that Chris Farley character, the Chris Farley show, when he's like, remember that time?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I feel like I'm going to do. Remember that time when you did a documentary? Yeah, that was awesome. I'm going to try and avoid that. So, but I kind of want to... I don't know. And you tell me if you don't want to talk about this, but Beauty is Embarrassing is literally one of my favorite art documentaries ever.
Thank you.
And do you want to talk about it?
Sure. Wait, I got to open this door again. The dog is at the door. Sorry.
He wants to be on it. That's cool.
Sorry. No, go ahead. We can talk about the movie. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, because it kind of covers everything that, you know, I'd ask you anyway. And actually, the first time I saw it, I was on a plane. I downloaded it, and I was flying back from Chattanooga, of all places.
Huh.
And which was weird, because I've already felt connected to you, because I'd just been in Chattanooga, and you had already done the interview for the book. And I was flying back, and I watched it, and I cried like 4 times on a plane.
They say you cry easier at movies or something on a plane.
On a plane, something about the altitude?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I just watched it again and I cried again. So what made you do the documentary?
To make people cry.
Mission accomplished.
I didn't want to do the doc. That was the director's idea, Neil Berkeley. He approached me with it initially. In 2009, when my book came out,
yeah,
the Todd Oldham Design Big Book, which was very exciting for me, and Neil saw it and got the idea to make a 10-minute piece about my work, kind of displaying what he can do at his company, blah, blah, blah. You know, it was just going to be this little nothing. And then it grew from there, and... That was Neil. Neil Berkeley.
Were you friends with him, or did he just know you because of the book?
Oddly enough, I had met him 8 years prior to the book, around 2000, when he was an intern at a company I was working at.
Oh.
And then in 2009, he got back in touch with me. I barely remembered him. And that same company was his company now.
Wow.
That's Neil. That's Neil in a nutshell. That's how his ambition and his talent and his drive. And so he got this whole documentary thing going.
And so it went from a 10-minute thing to an hour and...
to a full movie.
Yeah.
Neil's first directing.
So good. He did a beautiful job, like just, you know, telling the story and putting it all together. How long did it take you guys to do that? Because sometimes you've got a beard and sometimes you don't, and then you have a beard again.
Almost 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah, from 2009 to 12. It premiered in 12.
And so how did you feel, like, because it wasn't really your idea, was it weird talking about yourself like that? Or, like, you know, what did you think it was going to be like?
Well, I didn't take it very seriously at all. And as far as filming, it was very unobtrusive because, they have those tiny little cameras now.
Mm-hmm.
There was no lighting. Sometimes he wouldn't even put a mic on me, but sometimes he would. So it was just Neil with this tiny little camera the size of a pack of cigarettes. So it didn't feel like I was being filmed. It felt like I was just talking to Neil or doing an interview for a magazine or something.
Mm-hmm.
I was used to at that point. So it wasn't, didn't seem different from my usual routine.
I think that's what's so nice about it is, I mean, calling you today, I was so nervous, but I've watched that movie so many times, and it's sort of like you feel like you know you because you're just so relaxed and candid through the whole thing. Like, you know, he did a really great job, and so did you, just being relaxed.
You should see the stuff he didn't use.
Really? Was there tons of it?
As he shot hours. That's, you know, he flatters me. Of course he does. He makes me look great.
I really liked all the swearing.
It's a whole other ball of wax.
That'll be Beauty is Embarrassing Part 2.
Yeah. Well, really embarrassing.
That's what it can be called. Really, really embarrassing. No, it was just so good. And
that's much, much credit goes to Neil.
Well, what did you think when you saw it? Did you see it in the making, or did you sort of just see it all at the end?
I got this superstitious thing going that I didn't want to see it in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be that way. I can get on a track like that and stay on it. And so I decided I didn't want to see it in the making. I thought it got to a point where I was getting good feedback from everybody who saw it, and I didn't want to, like, I just let him, I trusted Neil.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I saw it, I saw it at the premiere.
Wow.
In Austin, South by Southwest.
How many times did you cry?
Me? I haven't cried yet.
No. Oh my God. Mrs. Stoddard broke me. That's where it all went downhill on the plane. And then your dad...
That was absolutely real. And yeah, my father, you know, crying.
Oh, God, that killed me. And then I think for me, you know, my jam with the whole creative block and inner critics and all that stuff. I've had such a struggle with that and always felt narcissistically alone in that. I always thought that I was the only creative person that felt like that. That's how special and unique I am. And then... you know, when I did Creative Block and you get all these interviews back and you realize that these people who you admire so much creatively feel exactly the same way. It's just this huge weight off your shoulders. And that was the next round of crying in the movie, was the Who's He Think He Is painting. And the fact that you talked about that. And I kind of wondered if that was part of Neil getting you to relax, like the fact that you so openly talked about, you know, those, the self-doubt and the inner critics and all that crap. And, you know, do you talk about that freely, or is that because he relaxed you?
He relaxed me.
Well, you know,
he like, me. No, I don't talk about that. He brought me out.
Yeah.
Some different ways. Yes, absolutely.
I thought so, because it is hard to get people to talk about that stuff.
Yeah, that's part of his talent as a filmmaker and as a storyteller. He knows what to ask, and he knows how to interview, and he knows the emotional parts of the story he wants to find, you know.
So afterwards, were you like, oh my God, I can't believe I talked about that?
No.
No.
I thought it was, no, that's, you know, the insecurity of the artist is, you know, I'm glad to share that. We all have it. Mm-hmm. And that's why everybody, you know, I felt secure that it was universally felt and known. So I didn't feel particularly weird or vulnerable talking about it.
Yeah, no, and nor should you. I don't know why I ever thought I was the only one that thought that. But and so do you really care what people think of you or your work, or no?
Of course I do, you know, up to an extent. Yeah, you know, we're all in a society together, and as much as you try to be independent of spirit, you know, you can't. You always think about what other people are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good habit to get into.
No, it seems like, I don't know, it seems like you don't. Like, I really admire that you're just always making stuff and you're always trying different things and you're changing directions and kind of pushing yourself. And I was just wondering, like, you know, when you decide, like, oh my God, I need a break from this, I'm going to try painting instead. In your head, are you like, it's just something creatively that you want to do? Or do you have that moment where you're like, oh my God, I wonder how this is going to be received?
I don't worry about how it's going to be received. I'm just grateful for the chance to be able to experiment and follow different paths.
Mm-hmm.
And that sense of gratitude is what I concentrate on most. Mm-hmm. I try to. And everything else just kind of falls away, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm so happy to be able to be doing it that that gives me confidence and it shows in the work, you know? So
yeah,
and that's taken me a long time to get to that place. I've spent years and years when I was younger, completely, you know, full of doubt and self-consciousness and doing it for this person or that person. Everybody does that.
Yeah.
Everybody is doing it for somebody else, sort of. You never kind of get away from that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And do you find that, like, do you ever, because you just do so many cool things, do you ever get burnt out?
Yes.
And so when you get burnt out, I want to know what that looks like when Wayne White gets burnt out. Do you just stop making for a little while, or is that physically possible?
Well, I get burnt out when I go out on the road and I'm gone for a month and doing big installations. You know, those are huge jobs. And you get home from one of those, even a week or 2 weeks on the road working, you get burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
It's tired. It's very tired.
And so when you get home, do you want to sort of putter in your studio, or do you kind of just want to do nothing?
I compulsively draw all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my default position, always drawing in a sketchbook. So I never stop drawing. You know, I've got a sketchbook in every room, and, you know, that's just something I do.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty relaxing.
Yeah, it's meditative, you know, and it's just, I have it, I've always had. Since I was 3 years old. So I keep that part of art making alive through drawing. But yeah, I'll go a week or 2 weeks without starting another project, just drawing and reading. And, you know, I do get burnt out.
Yeah.
I used to brag that I didn't. No, I never stop, blah, blah. But I just... shit.
I know it is. It's hard to keep that momentum constantly. Like, you know, I think that of you because it just seems like you know, that's how you are. But it's just like that can't be right.
And it's a lot though.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I pride myself on that.
Mm-hmm.
Although
I have to say it was really refreshing. I emailed you after the book was done and I needed blurbs written for the back and I really wanted you to write on the back, and you had just been doing all the Beauty is Embarrassing tour basically. And you sent me a very, I don't know if you remember this, you sent me a very, very sweet email saying, you know, that you loved everything I was doing, but you were just done and burnt out and didn't really want to talk about art for a little while.
Yeah.
And I thought, I loved that so much in a way, because it, you know, humanized you even more. It's like, oh, okay, then that's okay that I get exhausted sometimes too, you know? Because I find that I go, and then I'll just hit a wall and it's just like, oh my God, I just need to not think about this for a few minutes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, I got really burnt out on talking about myself
mm-hmm.
during that whole period. And
how many events did you do?
Oh, countless.
Yeah.
I went to like, you know, 25 cities, and it started a trend in my life of traveling more. And I still do. I still travel, you know, 5 or 6 times a year.
Mm-hmm. Do you go on your own or does Mimi go with you?
Mimi goes with me usually when we're, you know, when it's a week or so.
Yeah.
I haven't done a month long. We do residencies together. We went to Key West together this year. And
still, oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, some of it's really nice travel, and then sometimes it's hard work.
Sometimes yeah.
I'm building something on site. That's when I get burnt out, is when I'm building on the road.
Yeah.
But, I went through a very unique experience of having a movie made about me and then going out on the road and talking about it.
Yeah.
Being this kind of public figure in a weird kind of way from out of the blue, just overnight, you know, and, you know, compared to most, it was very low level, but still for me, it was, I'm still thinking about what happened.
Yeah.
It's only 3 years ago.
Well, yeah, to have a spotlight on you like that.
Yes, I always say you stay in the spotlight too long, it'll burn a hole through your head.
Is that kind of how you felt by the end?
Yeah.
Yeah. And did you get, like, there's a really cool scene right at the very beginning where you're backstage somewhere with your banjo and you take a couple of deep breaths before you go out. Did you feel nervous before you would do those events?
You know, I don't. The only thing I get nervous about is playing the banjo in front of me. I'm not very good at all. I'm a total amateur. So it's like, so that's the only thing that makes me nervous. Talking in front of people doesn't make me nervous at all. I don't get stage fright, you know.
Yeah.
That's part of, Neil brought that out too, you know. He helped me create this stage show that I still do, that's excerpted in the movie, you know.
Yeah.
I still do that. I just did it a few weeks ago.
How long is that show?
It's about an hour long.
Mm.
And it's, you know, it's a keynote, you know. Pictures and video and a little bit of really bad banjo playing.
Well, it's better than my banjo playing. I'm glad I don't have to take a banjo out on any stages.
Yeah, it's I do it real quick.
Yeah, okay.
Leave them wanting more.
So let's talk a little bit about the first thing that made me cry, Mrs. Stoddard.
Yeah. That was a real scene. That was absolutely real.
So did they plan it? Like, did they
surprise me on camera?
Oh.
That was one of our trips down to Chattanooga. That was probably in 2010 or 11. And we've gone down there to shoot a lot of footage and do interviews. That's when Neil had they had another guy, two cameras. And they totally surprised me.
That is so cool. That was such a neat moment. And, you know, I talk about that a lot with people because I've been doing the traveling and talking thing too. And so many of the stories that I hear after, and I'm sure you get this too, you know, afterwards when you actually chat with the people, you get all these sort of Me Too stories. And so many of the stories that I hear revolve around teachers.
Yes.
And it's either that a teacher told them, do you know Esther Pearl Watson?
I do. Yes. And yeah. Mark Todd. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just had Esther on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. We just met in New York. She's just so great. And she, just like you, was Mrs. Stoddard first grade?
First grade.
Yeah. Yep. So she had a second grade teacher and she said they did a poem in class. And she said, I think my picture was like 3/4 of the page and the poem was like tiny in the top. And the teacher said, you know, I think you're going to be an artist when you grow up. And she said, yes, I think I might be. And so many people have those stories, or it goes the other way where they had a first, second, third grade teacher who said that their art was terrible.
Oh, yeah.
And they've never made since.
Yes.
And so do you hear that story a lot? Like when you tell the Mrs. Stoddard thing?
Oh, you know what? I don't. Now that I think of it, a lot of people haven't shared that kind of story with me.
Oh, I'm surprised because that was the first thing when I saw that. I was like, oh my God, I hear that story repeatedly. And I love that. So can you tell that story about first grade?
Well, yeah, it was my, my first day in first grade. I'd never been to kindergarten. Back then, it didn't seem to matter. I don't know why, but I went straight from home to first grade.
So this was literally your first day of school then?
Well, if I wanted to dramatize it, I would say it was literally my first day. Okay. Actually, it was my second day.
Oh, okay. We'll take the drama out of it.
The first day, this is the true story. The first day was we all went in, and of course everybody's freaked out. You're suddenly thrust into this weird society, you know. It's a desperate, you know, it's one of the great traumas of childhood, you know, starting school. So to occupy, she get passed out the Manila construction paper and told us to draw our lunch from that day. So I drew an aerial view of the lunch tray with the food and the little compartments and stuff. And then the second day of first grade, we came back into the room and I noticed all the drawings up all over the walls, but I didn't see mine anywhere. And I was starting to pout a little bit. Oh. Everybody sat down and she was telling everybody about how she loved everybody's drawings. But
then she
pulled out mine. And held it up. It was just like, what? She says, but I especially want to talk about this drawing by Wayne White. And she made me come up in front of everybody. And the heavens parted, you know, this light shone down on me. You know, she goes, this young man is going to be an artist one day. And that's how it started totally.
That's
second day.
So cool, man. She was right.
Well, it was a perfect confluence of things. It was like I needed some way to survive in this savage new world I was into, and at the same time, she gave me instant street cred as the artist, and everyone's in awe. Totally, I could see it in all their faces. So, in one master stroke, I had found my niche. In this Lord of the Rings, I mean Lord of the Rings, Lord of the Flies world, and I saw the power of art right in a flash. I mean, my parents, I was from this insular world of this little neighborhood. Nobody really knew what an artist was. My mother had vague notions of art, but you know, I had a complete naive, you know, little kid's idea of just drawing for fun. But then in that one moment, I understood its power in the culture, you know, I couldn't say that then, but looking back, yeah.
And after that, that was it. You were just the art kid.
I was it, man. I was the artist of the school, unchampioned for 12 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it went in and out. I went in and out of fashion, but I was always the only kid in school who could draw. No competition, none.
That's awesome. That's sort of how I was too. I was totally the art kid. And then I got to university to do art, and it was like a giant punch in the face, and I did not fit in at all. And I was just like, what? But I'm the art kid, and you had an amazing university experience.
Well, it wasn't that great a university, you know, it was okay. It was just a mediocre state university, but the art department was kind of special at the time because of my fellow students, you know.
It was like you found your people, it seemed like.
That was the first time I'd met other artists, literally. There were no other artists from 1 through 12 for me in my little world. That was it. So the first time I met other artists. As a first time I could, and I could still draw better than anybody. I always prided myself on that until I got to New York City.
Yeah.
Then that was just shattered.
You lost your gold trophy.
No, I was completely humbled. That's one of the big lessons I talk about when I talk to art students or young people. I always say, go somewhere where everybody's better than you. It'll put a fire under your ass and make you much better.
Yeah.
It'll discourage you forever.
Did it knock you down, or were you just inspired by everybody around you, or were you a little bit like, oh shit, I'm not the.
Well, no, it inspired me to be better.
Yeah.
You know, why not?
Yeah. Your story is just so amazing. Like everything, you know, that happened in New York and Pee-wee's Playhouse, like that's so crazy. Like, how did that come about exactly?
Well, I was lucky to be there at the right time, at the right place.
How did you even know to go in? Like, was it an open call for like artists?
Yeah. Hey, it was. I had done a show prior to that in Tennessee. It's talked about in the movie called Mrs. Cobble's Caboose.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
That was the first professional set and puppet job I'd ever done. And that was in the fall of 85. Before that, I'd just been doing like sloppy ass performance art stuff, blah, blah, blah. But that was the first time I'd gotten it.
But that wasn't in New York, was it?
It's in Nashville.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd gone down for a few months and I was still living in New York, but I went to Nashville and made that show.
Oh, okay.
I came back with that portfolio. And of course, Pee-wee was real hot at the time. He had just done the Tim Burton, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And I heard from this guy, the late Jay Kennedy, who a lot of people were from the cartooning and illustration world of New York from that era will remember. He was an art director. At the time, he was an art director at Esquire magazine, and he knew Mimi.
Oh, okay.
Really well. As through the cartooning world. And Jay told Mimi that Pee-wee was going to do a TV show, CBS show. That's how I heard about it. And I called, and it was kind of just an open call for designers. So I found out it was at this place called Broadcast Arts, and I went over there and showed them my Mrs. Cobble's Caboose portfolio. And so, you know, it was just one of those. Oh, you know, it was kind of an open call.
That it was like a perfect match. And what's her name? Mrs. Cobble's Caboose?
Yeah.
That was like a little mini Pee-wee's Playhouse. Like it was such a perfect little learning ground because you can totally see the connection.
And I was already, you know, I was already hip to Pee-wee when I did Mrs. Cobble. I knew about the, you know, I had all these different influences. I always say it's the cross between Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and a little golden book, you know. Yeah. I've been in the underground cartooning world, and I'd seen Pee-wee's show on HBO. I knew Gary's work very well. I was a huge fan of Gary Panner's. So, I that was already in the mix when I did the Nashville show. So it was perfect, yeah.
Yeah.
It was kind of just leading up to that. And and then Gary, of course, came along and Rick Heitzman, and we had an amazing time.
It seems like it. It just seemed like a big candy box for you guys. And it was really cool. Like, you know, I mean, I grew up watching that. And then to see, you know, in the documentary talking about it, it did seem more like, now as an adult looking back, it seemed more like an art piece.
It was.
Yeah.
That's another one of my talking points that I always say. It was an art piece. It just happened to get on CBS television. That's, you know, that ain't easy to do.
Yeah, no kidding.
We were all downtown artists. We weren't the usual Hollywood crew. We were all doing this job for the first time. We were cartoonists and painters and sculptors.
Yeah, like would that ever happen again? Like,
well, you know, it's rare. Yeah,
yeah,
it's rare because Paul was such an artist himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, of course, a CalArts grad. He knew all about the art world and the process of making good stuff. And he knew who to hire. So, you know,
yeah,
he's a great boss.
Perfect storm.
Yeah.
Well, and it's so funny because when I first found out about you, I don't think I told you this in our many emails, never actually speaking, that before I found you, I was buying thrift shop paintings and painting on them. And I thought I was a genius because no one had ever done this before. And then I found you and I was like, shit. And I was like, oh, forget it. But I have a studio literally filled with, you know, the bad ones, you know, the printed ones. I never buy the ones that somebody's actually made. I always buy the cheap printed ones.
Yeah.
They're way better anyway. And then you don't feel guilty.
Yeah.
And so that's how I knew. So when I started digging around and found out the Pee-wee's Playhouse thing, I was just like, what? And then I just dug and dug and dug and found out, you know, everything you've done is just so crazy, which is why I was so insanely nervous to call you. But what is it? So you kind of accidentally found the thrift shop painting thing, right? You were using them for the frames?
Yeah, that's why I had some laying around. I was interested in the frame that they were in. And I did the first one just as a kind of spur-of-the-moment experiment.
Mm-hmm.
That truly is how the first one happened. I had in mind to do these big word monuments in a landscape, but I was going to paint the landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was in this kind of realist mode at the time, doing these kind of 19th century almost type history paintings. And so I did that. I tried it as an experiment. And now here I am, you know, 15 years later.
How many do you think you've done? Do you know?
No, not really. I would say I've done at least 500.
Wow.
Yeah, mate.
Don't you find it? I find it so satisfying in my hand. I don't know what it is about painting on that surface. It's so smooth or something.
Yeah, it's, to tell you the truth, it's like I am getting a little burned out on doing them.
Are you? Well, 500. That'll do it.
I shouldn't. I mean, I do find new ways, you know, it's been a challenge to keep it fresh.
Do you ever take breaks from them?
Yeah, I mean, I build giant sculptures and puppets, and I get to do all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Of course, I work on paper all the time. I'm grateful for them, actually. Mm-hmm. I very much am. They've led me to some amazing places.
Yeah, like the Todd Oldham book.
The Todd Oldham book. They've taken me to Italy. They've taken me, I mean, they've, you know, they were, they got me into the art world.
Mm-hmm. Was that an accident?
Well, it was kind of a, you know, something I've been dreaming of. And, I've been working towards it, but I had no confidence about getting in, though. None. Because I'd been a kiddie show designer for so long that, I kind of just, it was a miracle to me that I met this guy, Cliff Benjamin, who started showing me in LA. way back in 1999. But it was no accident. I wanted to. I wanted desperately to be in a gallery.
But
I
did you think it would be those word paintings that did it?
No, not at all.
That's what I meant by the accident, not that.
No, it didn't. It's life is funny, you know.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of funny, that's one thing that I love so much about your work and you is your sense of humor, because I found the same thing. Like, you know, I've been in the art world for a long time, then took a big chunk of time away from it. And I've been a graphic designer most of my life. And just with the blog, so I started it 7 years ago, got back into the art world in my own kind of little way. And I like funny stuff, and it's not very welcome. Like,
no,
it drives me crazy. And actually, that's one of the reasons I love Esther Pearl Watson so much, and Martha Rich, and these artists that are, and you, that are still making art, but it makes you laugh. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. And so I love, that was another part that made me cry, because I think it just touched a nerve with me, because I got really slammed for that in art school.
Yes.
And to see you doing it on this scale, being praised, and it's just like, oh, it just makes me so happy.
Oh, good. I'm not always praised.
Well, that's okay. Some praise is good.
That's what sort of opened the door for me. It was like I just finally relaxed and said, you know, I like this. This seems to be natural for me. I'm tired of trying to be so meaningful or serious or trying to fit in all these other niches. This just comes naturally to me, and I'm just going to do it. Fuck it.
Well, that's kind of why I said, like, do you care?
That's the point everybody needs to find with themselves.
Yeah.
You know?
That's why I asked you at the beginning, do you care what people think? Because I kind of love that you say, fuck it, you know? And it's just like the hilarious sayings and the fact that, you know, at the beginning.
I did find a place where I could, where I didn't care what people think. Yeah. Yes, I did. And I still can go there.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that, you know, there's other aspects of life where I'm way more self-conscious. But I am lucky enough to find a place with picture making that I can just, you know, be completely free, if only for a little while.
Yeah.
And that's what humor and stuff did for me. It did free me up.
It's so funny because I want to do a show of all women, humor-based women artists, and it's really hard to find them. I think because, you know, you want to be taken most artists want to be taken seriously.
Yes.
So your work can't be hilarious, or how can you possibly be serious? And so I really want to do a big humor-based show. And then it was so funny because all along, Jealous Curator's been my mask to hide out from making my own work, you see. I just write about other people. And then I realized that when I make my own work, I make funny things. And to me, that didn't count because I was like, well, it's funny, so it doesn't really count. And then hence crying in Beauty's Embarrassing, because I was like, oh, it does count.
Yeah.
And so I want you to, like, I'm trying not to be the fangirl and like, remember that time you did the funny painting? That was awesome. But remember that time you did the funny painting? Because it was awesome. And it's meant so much to me, and you probably have no idea, but I just wanted you to know.
Well, you know, I always say also, it's like whatever counts for you, you know.
Yeah.
I get a little tired of hearing myself bang the drum for humor. You know, it's like you can't, I don't want to be the spokesperson for any one sensibility or say that this is the way to go or my belief is the best belief. That's really not what I'm trying to get at. The real message is like, you know, finding that place, like we were just talking about, where you're just free.
Yeah.
And of course, the humor thing validated that for you and for me, and that's great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, Wayne. Okay. Only thing left. Speed round.
Okay. Go ahead.
It's pretty easy. Ready?
Yes.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Me too. High fives. Humor and coffee. Okay. First song you ever slow danced to?
Oh, geez.
You can make it up if you can't remember.
That was in junior high. I did some slow dancing in junior high. So lots of junior high school dances. The only one I can really remember, the only memory I have is the Poor Side of Town. Have you ever heard of that song?
No.
Welcome. That's how old I am. It was a live band too.
Wow.
The Poor Side of Town.
Do you remember the girl?
It was probably Dee Deacons. That song, Poor Side of Town.
Okay, well, I'll put it in the post. People can listen to it and imagine you slow dancing.
Oh, it's so sexy.
Okay, I'm on it. Thrift shop or dumpster diving? Where do you get the best stuff?
Well, of course, I get all those pictures at thrift stores.
Yeah.
And Mimi does most of the heavy lifting there because she likes to shop and she likes thrift stores more than I do. So that's where those come from. But myself, I do. I like dumpster diving a little better. I used to do it at the best dumpsters in the world, which was studios in Hollywood. They throw out stuff.
I was just going to ask where the best ones were.
The best dumpsters are on lots. Which people can't get to on studio lots outside of sound stages.
What's the best thing you've ever found back there?
Oh, I don't know. Just raw materials like styrofoam and wood and unlimited foam core.
Yeah.
Just sheets of foam core.
Just load up your truck to the, just back it up.
Yeah. I'm not looking for like treasures, like, objects of art. Raw materials usually when I think of dumpster diving.
Fair enough. You should see I live in a really tiny little town, and our thrift shops are so good.
I bet.
They have no idea what they've got.
You know what? It's getting a little harder for me to find my pictures out here.
Well, you should come visit me.
First of all, I've got an army of people that are imitating me now. They're going out and buying thrift store painting. Thrift store reproductions.
Yeah.
So I really do think, I'm being undermined.
You probably are. That's why I told you that I was doing it before I saw your work.
I didn't invent it. It's collage.
It is.
It's appropriation. It's been around for 100 years.
Well, one of the reasons I started doing it was that I was feeling so guilty about buying all these canvases. And I was like, it just felt like such an environmental waste, just to keep buying all this stuff. And I was like, well, these things are already like ready to go.
They are.
They're already in the world. And so why not recycle them?
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, last one. If you could live anywhere in the world, where would you live?
I'm pretty happy right here where I am in my beautiful home in the Los Angeles Hills.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy here.
Love LA too.
I've got a great house. That's the number one thing.
Yeah.
It's your house,
A good house with good people in it with you.
Yes.
Yeah. I know. I feel the same way, but I do love LA. I come there a lot, weirdly. And we almost met when I was at Skylight. But you were away somewhere.
Oh.
Next time.
Yes.
Yes. I have a new book coming out, so I will purposely plan my LA trip for when you're home. So that we've gone from email to voice. Now we just actually have to meet one day.
Sure. Let us know when you're in town.
I will. Well, thank you so much for doing this. And I didn't cry or throw up or anything. So I feel like it was a victory.
Well, I cry a little.
Just that one part.
This is great.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure, my pleasure.
Okay, well, I'll talk to you soon. I'll let you know when I'm in LA.
All right.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And exhale. Wow. I loved every single second of that. And kind of had a few out-of-body experiences. But anyway, I really did cry through Beauty's Embarrassing, so I'm really, really happy that I did not cry during that interview. Now that would have actually been embarrassing. Thank you so much to Wayne for being so generous with his time and his amazing stories. Thanks to Saatchi Art for supporting the episode. And of course, as always, a huge thank you to you for listening. There will be more Art for Your Ear next weekend. See you then.